focus on a contribution where these guys are later than these guys, and you put a particular particle as the intermediate state. So we're looking at some process with, say alpha, and a bunch of operators here. So, the late ones are the x's. The claim was, so we're going through an exercise which is showing that this thing, in the same way that the correlation functions had singularities in particular kinematic regions for which the residues related to S matrix elements, the claim was here that the correlation function was going to have a singularity corresponding to a particular particle going on shell, which we're identifying here. And we're identifying it by taking the case where we sum over all possible particles that could be contributing in the particular ordering where all these operators are here and all those operators are there. And so the logic from here on in is basically much like it was last time. We're going to do the point of the exercise so far has just been that we've made the x and y dependence explicit. There's nothing in these matrix elements anymore that depends on that or in this stuff here. So the only explicit stuff is here and in these two factors. So if we can do those integrals, again, we're going to get one of them will give us a delta function. The other one will give us, would like to give us a delta function except for the step function. And so it'll give us something else. It'll give us the pole that we're looking for. And the upshot will be that there's a kinematic region where there's a pole corresponding to the particles that could actually be exchanged from here to here. And at that point, the pole correlation function, if you sit at that pole, the residue factorizes into a pair of amplitudes which are involved in the production of this particle and the absorption of that particle. And I hadn't finished the last few steps, so let me just finish those steps. So we want to do the x and y integral. We want to take advantage of the fact that only one combination appears in the step function. Then that's the difference, so let's call z, let's define that to be x minus y. And instead of doing, d4x, d4y, we'll do d4z, d4y. Because the Jacobian is 1. So in these variables, the y-integral only involves these phases. It'll pick up, so we have to write in that phase, x is equal to y plus z. So there'll be a piece here where we've got a y in both those phases. And so we'll have the integral d4y, v to the I, da-da-da-da-da, is going to give us 2 pi to the fourth, delta to the fourth. It'll be the difference, or I guess the sum of those two things in the exponent. So we'll get a sum over k of pk plus capital P beta minus sum over k qk and then the integral over z is going to have partly it'll come from that phase, but then it'll also have a step function. So we'll have integral d4z of e to the I or minus I. Let me just call that thing P. Capital P minus K. So I've defined P mu to be P beta plus the sum of these little p's. And by this delta function, that's also equal to P alpha plus the sum of the other ones. And then tau is just the thing in the step function here. So tau is min x bar naught minus max y bar naught. So I won't do it again, but we've done this integral before, and it's, excuse me. So it's, I to I cubed. The spatial part is a delta function because the step function only involves the time part, so we'll get a capital P minus K. And the time part gives us this e to the I p naught minus k naught tau divided by and it's the usual deal where we can multiply and divide this factor. So this factor here, we can write it as being e to the I p naught tau times p naught plus k naught divided by and again because k is equal to p and k naught, you know, k is labeling a state, right? It's something which we actually stuck in here. So its energy is not independent of its momentum. So it's the square root of k squared plus the mass of whatever that state is. So k naught, this thing here is just, you know, I can write that as, this is just minus k squared minus m squared. But k is also equal to p. So I can also call that capital P squared minus m squared. And this whole thing then becomes the four momentum minus p squared. So I must just write that in, because this will be same story as before. And I don't know how long we want to flog this here. Let me just, you can kind of see now the factor is it. So the singularity we're talking about is this pole. If you focus at the, so if you choose your momenta such that you're near the pole, then the residue, we can do the K integral with the delta function, and the residue of the pole is going to be something which, for which this thing doesn't really contribute because it's not contributing the pole. And so all this, all you're getting is this term, and it's explicitly factorizing these things. And if we chosen the correlation function which had no operators in it, so that it was, this was just all one, then we would have had an S matrix element. We would have had something where we had particles going to particles, and then in that special case, these are just, you know, matrix elements from alpha that goes to K and K goes to beta. And that's showing you that scattering amplitudes are also factorizing the same way. If there's a situation where you can produce a particle and it goes on shell, that'll be actually a very big contribution to your amplitude because of this pole. And in that limit, the S matrix element is going to factorize into the amplitude for producing the particle and then the amplitude for it to be destroyed in a way that agrees with what we expect on general grounds, that the probability of producing a particle and having it being destroyed should multiply because they're independent events. Strictly speaking, you could worry about this as this actually diverging. Normally, if something like that diverges, it means that one of your approximations failed. And so one way it could have failed is it could be that this particle is not stable, so it might be decaying. So it might be that that line should have really involved, there's a process where that particle can decay into something else with some coupling constant G here, there, say. But then this process where you imagine including things that are nominally higher order, you can kind of see are not small compared to what we're keeping because we're getting a factor of G here in each vertex. But if we're sitting on shell, all these, each factor of these internal lines is going like one over k squared. And so we're getting something which is, if this was diverging, then each of these is diverging even more because these things are all on shell at the same time. And what happens there is that in a way, but maybe we can do a little more detail later on, is if you have an unstable particle, what happens is that you can never actually quite get on shell. closest you can get is k squared is of the order of the mass times the width. And so that means that each of these things is going like 1 over g squared, it should be. The width. Mass and the width is just squared. So the width is of the order g squared. It's I take that amplitude squared to get the rate. That would be the width for the decay. And so the closest you can get to zero in the case of an unstable particle has these internal lines not going to infinity, but they're going to 1 over g squared. And then you can kind of see that these iterated insertions are not small compared to not inserting them. And so that particular class of things is what leads you to, if you plotted the rate for this process, you'd see that there's a big enhancement if you chose the momenta to be such that this thing sits on shell. And that's what that's the origin of resonances. And the relative size of the top of the resonance to everything else is normally of order 1 over g squared, because of the fact that you're basically, this propagator is an enhancement. It's not blowing up exactly, but it's blowing up to the extent that instead of being 1 over 0, it's 1 over g squared. And so that's that growth of the propagator as you sit as close as you can to the being on shell is what gives you the enhancement at resonance. So for example, if you take E plus E minus goes to a Z boson, which then decays, if you sit on resonance to a good approximation, you can think of that as being the production of the Z boson, which then later on decays. And the precise relationship between the rate for producing the Z boson and having it subsequently decay, calculated as one process, will factorize in this limit that you're sitting on the residue, so at the resonance, into a piece which is proportional to the cross-section for producing a Z, and then the decay width for the Z decay into the final particles you're looking at. Any questions about that? So this is just basically showing you that S matrix elements do what you think they should do. Yeah.
What about the chamber
break? Yeah, those are more subtle. Something else is breaking down there. The classic one is if you take a photon or something, and you send it, it's stable. Then the cross section for the differential cross section for scattering from a charge goes like 1 over q squared, and so q squared equals 0 really does diverge. And so what's happening there would be that's a if q squared is equal to 0 and you've got a charge, then you're looking at very small angle scattering if the momentum transfer is small. And what really happens then is that it depends on your setup, but for real, if you're looking at electron scattering from a charge in a solid or something, what really happens then is that you're being screened by other charges. And so the small q squared limit will be dominated by the long field limit. And again, the message is always, if you're getting an amplitude which is diverging, then something, you've left out something that's as big as what you were supposed to keep in, so your approximations are failing. In this case, what you'd be missing is the screening. But there'll be something, if you really want to sit at very, very, very small angle scattering, there'll be something which makes your problem make sense. And you're missing that in the calculation that gives you the divergence. And so you have to go back and think about what it was that was competing with the graphs that you did that are not suppressed and are making everything finite. And that's a special case of what we're going to get to in infrared divergences, that whenever you have a problem for small momenta where things diverge, as you do have, as you'll see, it means you're asking not a physical question quite. If you ask a physical question, then those divergences go away. But if you kind of just ask some random question, then you'll get divergences that look like they're a problem. Okay. So if you're happy with that, I was going to drop that. And then the next topic would be the Lehmann-Shalane representation. So we're kind of going through a series of exact things you can say about in field theories. So I'm not Scandinavian, I don't know how to pronounce things, but when I was a student, Weinberg pronounced that Shalane, and he apparently knew Shalane. So my understanding is that's pronounced Shalane. But anyway, this is the representation we're talking about. And it's essentially just doing what we've been doing here, but doing it for a simple thing like a propagator. So let's say, take a complex scalar field, as an example. You know, 5x. And let's look at the propagator in g of xy, which would be, you know, the vacuum time ordered product. Where those are Heisenberg operators. And let's just do what we've been doing for this particular thing, and you'll see that there's all the information in this function comes down to really one unknown function. Because the dependence on x and y, there's more variables. It looks like there's a lot of variables here, but in a translationally invariant world, things only depend on the difference between x minus y, and in a Lorentz invariant world, there's only really combinations of x and y that are relevant. And it just boils down to there's one unknown function in G, which is a Lorentz invariant function of one variable. It's positive. And the goal would be to write G in terms of that unknown function. Along the way, it's useful to talk about the Whiteman function, which is a thing without the time ordering. And let me make sure I write it in the right order. Yeah. If we'd been doing free fields, we could have just evaluated these things, right? So let me just remind you of that. So, you know, for free fields, if we calculated the Feynman function g of x, y, it would have been, you know, the thing we've always been using, integral d4p over 2 pi to the fourth. E to the I, p of x minus y, over p squared plus m squared minus I epsilon. So this would have been, if we'd, in terms of these operators, if we'd done this in the interaction representation, this would have been 0, you know, time-ordered product of the interaction representation 5x, y star y. So let me call that instead of calling it the same thing, let me call that delta just to distinguish it from G. And if we'd done the Whiteman function, I'll call that delta plus. So if I define it to be interaction picture X, you know, you can pretty much do this by inspection, right? So if you phi interaction of X is integral d3p over 2 pi cubed twice the energy square root e to the I p to x a of p plus complex conjugate. So if you're just picking off the vacuum here, a star is going to pick off a star. I guess it's not, if it's a complex field, it's not complex conjugate. We'd have a particle antiparticle difference. We'd have e to the minus I p to x a bar star of p, where this just creates and destroys the antiparticle, and this creates and destroys the particle. So if we want phi star to have something non-zero here, we have to have a creation piece acting on it. So we'll take this thing complex conjugated, and we'll see this factor survive. And then we have to destroy it again to get this, and so we'll pick off this thing again. So this will evaluate to integral d3p. We'll get a 2 pi cubed from this factor here. We'll get a twice the energy. And then we'll get an e to the I. Complex conjugate would have given us a minus p dot y, so we'll have e to the I p dot x minus y. So that's what the Whiteman function would have been for a free particle. And it's irresistible to write this in a more covariant form. The integral d3, this looks like it's not very Lorentz covariant because we've got d3p here. But d3p transforms under Lorentz transformations like the energy does. So this ratio is actually covariant. And the simplest way to see that is to write this as a integral d4p, where we put in a delta function that puts the particle on mass shell. So the claim is this is equal to integral d4p over 2 pi cubed of delta
p squared plus m squared, the mass. A step function which says we take only the positive root for the energy times e to the I p x minus y. So to see why this is the same as this, all you do is you think of that as a function of p0 and do the p0 integral with the delta function. And you know that the delta, if you have delta of a function of x, that's delta of wherever f has a root, so let's call it xi, divided by the derivative of x at that root. So where f of xi is equal to 0. So this is just you do the change of variables for the delta function. So for this thing, this is a quadratic. This is minus p0 squared plus da da da. And so the it has a root for a positive value of p0 and a negative value of p0. But the step function says keep only the positive value. The derivative of this thing with respect to p0 is 2p0. And that's what that factor is. And so if you use this chain rule to do the p0 integral, you see those are the same. And this is actually manifestly covariant because there's only support for space like p squareds. For space like p squareds, sorry, time like p squareds, for time like p squareds, the sine of p0 is Lorentz invariant because that's inside the light cone. And everything else here is Lorentz invariant. So this is explicitly Lorentz invariant, and it shows you that this has to be as well. It's covariant when x and y are, it's thought of as a function of x and y.
Why do you have the interaction field of the x variable?
No, because I just forgot to write it. Thank you. So if we'd done those things for the free thing, we would have had this. And so so now we just use some tricks to relate them to each other. Okay, so we go back to the one we really wanted to evaluate. Let them do over here. What we've been doing in all these other things is evaluating things by putting complete sets of states in. So let's try that. So let's take W of X and Y. So that's just repeating the definition. So I put a complete set of states in. Then we'll have 0, 5x, n, y star of y, 0. So far, so good. I can also explicitly write the x and y dependence using translation invariance the way I've been doing right along. If I write this as the e to the minus I p dot x, e to the plus I p dot x on either side here. Same thing here, e to the minus I p dot y, e to the plus I p dot y. I let the p's act on the states using that the vacuum is invariant. Then what we'll get is this will be the sum over n of e to the I, momentum of the state n, and we're going to get here a plus I p dot x, so it'll be x minus y. And in many cases, you know, these vacuum, this is the in vacuum, this is the out vacuum, so they're not the same thing. But in many systems, they are the same thing up to a phase. That if you take, you know, we're taking a system and we're turning on the interactions adiabatically, something happens, we turn them off again. And so it's often the case, it's often true that zero in and zero out differ by a phase. In that case, we can set up the phases so that this thing is just, what you love to do, if you thought of these as the same state, then this is just the complex conjugate of that, right? So in this case where they're related by phase, we can arrange that the phases are such that is true. The naive thing would be true, in which case we'd have e to the I pn dot x minus y absolute value of 0, 5, 0, n.
So okay. So let me look at, so what's nice about this is that it's positive and it's zero unless we're talking about momenta for which a state exists for which the matrix element with phi in the vacuum is not zero. So what I want to do is rewrite this answer in terms of those things. And the way I'm going to do that is to start off thinking about functions like this. So imagine I got some function momentum, which I define to be a delta function of t minus some states times the absolute value of 0 by n. So the difference between this and that is just instead of the e to the ipx, I've got a delta function here. Now what we know about this is that it's I'm going to lie to you, actually. The argument I've got my notes, I think, is wrong. But no matter. I think it's the thing that's wrong is not important. The main thing is that we know this thing has support only for momenta for which there exists a state for which this matrix element is not zero. And so in particular, it only has support for positive values of P naught. So it's there's no loss of generality of writing this as being theta of p naught times something. I'm going to define the something to be this is the thing where I'm going to get in trouble, by the way. Oh, no, I'm okay. Right. So let me make the statement. So it has two properties. One is that it's Lorentz invariant. That's Lorentz invariant. This is a scalar, so this is Lorentz invariant. But the second thing is it only has support for time-like momenta, or possibly null momenta, so p squared is less than or equal to 0, and for which p0 is not negative. And so that allows me to write this thing the way I was about to write it here. So if I got theta of p naught, and there's a function which is a Lorentz invariant function of p, so it has to be a function only of p squared. And then I'm going to put in a factor of 2 pi cubed, I think, just on conventional grounds, if I'm right. So what we know about this rho is that it's a function of one variable, and it's positive. So rho is a positive function, or it's, I guess, a non-negative function. And it's non-negative just because we know that this is positive. Whenever this thing is not vanishing, it's equal to something which is a square. So the in terms of rho, we can write this. You know, what we had here was a delta function, but if I took this thing and I multiply it by e to the I p dot x minus y and integrate over p, I can get this, right? So I can write this as being the integral d4p over 2 pi cubed times theta of p0 rho of p squared times e to the I p dot x minus y. Right, so all I've done is to get this from this is I multiply this by e to the I p dot x minus y and do the integral d4p. So what I've done is I've taken this side of the equation and used that to get this. But if I now take the right-hand side of the equation and do the same thing, I get what I wrote here. If I'm right. Yes, God is great. And, you know, just to make myself feel stupid, conventionally, you write it as a function of, since p squared is negative, we can make it a function of a positive argument. So let's write the minus there. So that shows you that this Whiteman function is something which is completely governed by, there's only one, you can think of it as having only one unknown function here, which is this rho. And in particular, we can write this in terms of the free Whiteman function by doing the same kind of a trick. We can write this as being, I can factor out the rho. If I was doing the integral over p and I didn't see the rho here, then I'd just be calculating the free Whiteman function. So what I'll do is I'll just do a trick where I'll write this as being the integral from 0 to infinity d mu squared of rho of mu squared times a delta function p squared plus mu squared times the rest of the stuff, integral d4p over 2 pi cubed theta of p naught to the I p dot x minus y. So I've just done something stupid there, right?
But you get to take the delta function out of the integral.
Don't. And so the thing is, you recognize that this is just the Whiteman function that you would have had if instead of using the mass, you'd use mu squared as the mass. So we've got that. This is just the integral 0 to infinity d mu squared of rho of mu squared times delta plus of xy. And I'll put in mu squared here to emphasize that it's we're using mu squared as the mass rather than the real mass. So that kind of shows you that you can think of the exact Whiteman function as being an average of the real Whiteman function over this is called the spectral function. Which is essentially weighting. It's as if we're averaging over the masses of free particles, but we're giving each one a particular weight. And if we do the same kind of story for the Feynman function, it's the same thing. So we could equally well have written the W as a G of X Y and so if we use what the Feynman function actually was, that would be
Let's see, I want to write this in a particular way here. I'm going to make sure I write it the way I wanted to get the answer. Actually, this is not such a useful way to write it. I mean, let me write it as, let me come back to this. Just leave it at that. All right, so now we could have done the same thing with, phi and phi star are different. We could have done the same thing here. We could have done the Whiteman function with phi and phi star in the opposite order. And then instead of picking off the particles, we'd be picking off the antiparticles. So there'd be a very similar story in the free case. But in principle, we could have, in the exact case, we don't necessarily know that they're the same. But if we just do the same steps, if we do similarly, what we'll do is we'll define rho bar of mu squared by, let me get the definition right. So instead of using phi, so remember rho is defined by the board that I've removed here. Actually, maybe I should write it here. So we could take sum over n of delta p minus pn. And then the only difference is I'll take a matrix element of phi star rather than phi. So we'll write that as being theta of p naught. I'll call the spectral function rho bar of minus p squared. So in principle, these are independent functions, rho bar and rho, as far as we've gone so far. But we can relate them to one another. So let's go back here to do that. Let me bring my notes before I do that. So what I'm about to do is...
Can you please put down the board that you just...
Oh yeah, which one do you want? You want the this one here? So what I want to do now is relate rho to rho bar. And the way I'm going to do that is to use the fact that we know as an exact statement that phi and phi star commute at space-like separations. And so we know that the commutator of phi and phi star has to vanish at space-like separations. And we can express the commutator in terms of these Whiteman functions. And so we can get a relationship that involves rho and rho bar. So. We'll use that phi of x, phi of y star equals 0 if x and y are space-like separated. In other words, that x minus y squared is positive. Okay, so what we want to do is just calculate matrix elements of this and then use those definitions over there. All right, so what we'll do is we'll calculate 0, 5x, phi star of y. And so we know that this is 0 because of this. And I've missed a line here. So this I can write this as being sum of two terms, right? This will be the Whiteman function phi of x, phi star of y. And then there's the other Whiteman function involving phi star and phi. And I guess I should have written that over here. That if with this definition for rho bar, the
thing I should have written is that if we had calculated, remember this Whiteman function was phi with to the left, phi star to the right. We could also have calculated phi star phi y. And in the same way that we derive this, if you just chase through the definitions again, this is the integral 0 to infinity d mu squared of rho bar mu squared delta plus of x minus y mu squared. And it's not, you know, not a surprise. Put a complete set of states, we're going to get 0 phi star n, and that was the thing in terms of which we defined rho bar. So if I use this and this in that, I'm going to get the difference. So we'll get the integral 0 to infinity d mu squared. The first term will be phi star, so that'll be rho of mu squared. The next one will be phi star and phi, so it'll be rho bar of mu squared. Now this function, we know exactly what it is. And in particular, it doesn't vanish for space-like separated x and y. And that's kind of one of the ways, one of the steps in showing that you need antiparticles uses that fact, that if you just tried to build a field involving one kind of a particle without the antiparticle, then this would always fail because the commutator at space like x minus y would be this function which doesn't vanish. And so you need to have the particle and the antiparticle there to have their contributions cancel. But for this to, we need this to cancel for all values of x minus y. And so the only way that that can happen, given that we're integrating over positive functions of rho, is for this thing to vanish. So for all x minus y squared bigger than 0. So up to sets of measure 0. So that's one thing that tells us how rho and rho bar are related. So that means that we didn't have to keep rho bar as a separate variable. There's another relationship, an exact relationship that rho satisfied that comes from the canonical commutation relations. So a second identity comes from, let me get this right here. Where have we got that? So if I calculate the commutator instead of phi with phi star, if I take the momentum with phi, the momentum is basically phi dot. So let's calculate 0 commutator of phi dot of x with phi star of y. This should be equal to the should be minus I times delta of x minus y. X naught is equal to y naught. So the equals, this is an equal time commutator. And that's just because this is a momentum, this is a position, and this is the canonical commutation relation. So now we just do the same thing again. We have to put in the spectral functions. The only difference is that we got a time derivative at one point. So we're going to have to take a ddt of delta plus. But otherwise, it's the same. So it's equal to integral 0 to mu squared, rho of mu squared times evaluated at x naught equals y naught. And if you, delta plus is a known function, and it, I've got the factors right here. Yes. Bottom line is that if I use the properties of delta plus, this means that rho has to satisfy that it integrates to 1. So it's a positive function, integrates to 1, has support for positive values of mu squared. So if we go to now, we go back to the Feynman propagator. These expressions carry some of the folklore that you hear about the Feynman propagator. You can kind of see from those expressions. So if we define, you know, so with the Feynman propagator, we defined over there somewhere in momentum space. If we define, where's my definition here? Let's define G of P squared. So this is the Fourier transform of the Feynman propagator. So the integral d4x of e to the minus I P dot x of the time ordered product, but where we've translated everything to 0. So we have 5x, 5 star of 0. In position space, everything is a function of x minus y, so we can always translate one point to 0. So if we define g this way, then using what we had over there, g is rho of mu squared times the integral over mu squared of rho of mu squared times what we would have had if we Fourier transformed the Feynman function. So we would have had 1 over p squared plus mu squared times epsilon. So you know, what you often hear is that the Feynman function has poles at where particle states are. It has branch cuts where multiparticle states are. And you can kind of see why here now, because this explicitly shows you that it's thought of as a, if you think of this as a function of a complex variable p squared, then the singularities of the function are explicitly at places where p squared is equal to minus mu squared. But you only get something with a, not, with a support here if rho is non-zero. So you get a singularity if you have a mu squared for which rho is non-zero. But from the definition of rho, you only get a rho non-zero if you have a state. And where was the definition of rho? You only get a contribution to rho if you have a state for which there's a matrix element between the vacuum and that state of phi. And so those all have to be physical states. And so this shows you that you're, this shows you, you know, why that folklore is true. It shows you in particular that if there's a single particle state, so there's a, if you have an isolated, you know, if generically, if mu squared is, if rho is non-zero for some continuous range of mu squareds, then this is going to be some singularity as a function of p squared, which will be like a branch cut. It'll be there's a, there'll be a whole range of p squareds for which it's singular. But if you were to find a pole where p squared, where g of p squared was diverging, but it was analytic in the vicinity of that pole, that would correspond to a place where rho is vanishing everywhere except at one point. So rho would have a delta function contribution there. So a single particle contribution pole for g of p squared corresponds to rho of mu squared having some normalization, but then times delta of mu squared minus whatever the mass that state is. Whereas a multi-particle cut corresponds to a region where rho of mu squared
is positive for more than one mu squared. So if you plot So what are you expecting? And supposing we're talking about lambda phi, the fourth theory. So we've got a scalar field. It's got some interactions. We're expecting that there's a single particle state. There's also multi-particle states. There's scattering that goes on. What are we expecting to find for the spectral function? You're expecting to find, to the extent that you have a single particle state, you're expecting to find it has a pole. So you expect that it's a rho of mu squared would have some pole part if there's a single particle state in your system, but then it'll also have some continuum. Whereas the continuum typically won't start if you have single particle states and then scattering states, the first multiparticle state will start at twice the mass, and so if you plotted rho of mu squared against mu squared, what you'd expect to see is the pole at m squared. And then at 4m squared, there'd be a threshold where you'd start to see two particle states appear. And then three particle states would start at 9m squared. And then there'd be a different branch cut where you get the contribution of three particle states. But everything is always additive because this rho is always summing contributions, positive contributions to things that were already there. So what you expect in a weakly interacting field theory would be something like this, that to the extent that there really is a particle that this thing is describing, which is a single particle state, there's the corresponding pole. Its normalization has a factor in it, Z, which is what we've been calling until now the wave function normalization. The statement that this propagator has a pole with a particular residue is I've said it many times, but this is the exact statement. And this shows you that because rho is related to matrix elements, we know that whatever the residue of the pole is, it's to do with the overlap of the state, the single particle state. If this thing is proportional to, according to over there, the matrix element vacuum phi single particle state squared. And so the residue is telling you explicitly the size of the matrix element between the particle state of interest and your field. If you'd had a free field, Z would have been 1, and that means there's a perfect overlap between your field and the particle state. But in interacting field theory, there's not a perfect overlap, and so that there's a degraded, there's the matrix element 0 or vacuum phi n is not exactly 1 because there's also matrix elements with multiparticle states, and and they all had to sum up to 1 because this is more or less expressing unitarity.
You're saying that they're all additive, so this
function
is continually rising with mu. How can it sum up to 1?
Why do you think it can't?
Because if you have a function that's always increasing, then it diverges. Depends
how fast it increases, right?
No. If any function is finite, it's integrated over an infinite range, you can't get infinity.
Yeah. Yeah, but those are the ultraviolet divergences, right? That's the divergence you're getting is coming from infinitely large mu.
Right.
And so it is true that it diverges, but it's and so what that means is that if you cut it off at a particular value of mu, then if I were to use this in that, right, it says that that the single particle piece just picks off the Z, and then you've got a continuum piece, which starts off at the threshold, say 4m squared continuum. And so the whole conversation we had about Z being positive and it dependent on the cutoff, if the cutoff wasn't outrageously large, then when we calculated Z in the in QED, it was actually between 0 and 1. This says that Z has to be between 0 and 1 because it's less than 1 and there's some positive thing you're adding to it. So if when you cut the thing off, it really is true. But if you push the cutoff to infinity,
then it won't be true anymore. So never don't push cut off to infinity.
Is it true that the cutoff dependence will drop out of that interval? So the cutoff dependence is that will cancel the dependence from cutting off your interval?
In this formula?
Yeah.
Well, to the extent that one does depend on the cutoff, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
But so I'm not saying anything deep there. Yeah. So when you use normalized fields, all you're doing is you're scaling fields by Z. If we taste that through these definitions, then the normalized spectral function would be the bare one divided by Z. So you know, if we find a normalized field to be the original field divided by Z to the 1/2, which is what we did, you can see that the spectral functions, if you just chase it all through for the renormalized field, is going to be 1 over Z times the spectral function for the original field. And so if the original field had this Z in it, then we're going to find that this is equal to, it'll have a single particle pole or a delta function with unit coefficient, you know, by construction plus some continuum. And so another way of saying what the renormalized field was, if it's the one that was designed to make the residue of the pole, you know, for in G equal to unity, which is in perturbation theory what we were saying. But here you can kind of see it as an exact statement. And then the perturbative approximation is just you're imposing it order by order in perturbation theory. So I think I'm beating you over the head with this now. Yeah. So one last topic. Leaving these exact things was, we talked about reward identities along the way, and I made an argument for reward identities which was a bit fishy, but we can now make it clean because we have an exact statement. So we can express the reward identity argument that we used in renormalizing as in terms of the Heisenberg fields in QED, and I'm going to show you that it comes just from current conservation. So what brush now? Let me use this one here, I guess. I think that takes care of the dangling ends of things. So what I'm going to do is look at the following correlation function. So we're going to look at the integral e for x d for y. So we're going to momentum space e to the minus I p prime dot x plus p dot y. Time ordered product of a fermionic field psi n of x, electromagnetic current operator 0, psi bar m of y. And this I'm going to write as, I'm going to define the vertex function that we talked about before in this way. So it's going to be I times the charge of the field times the propagator, the exact propagator, S inverse, or S, I guess S prime, I called it nk, p prime. Gamma mu KL of P prime P times minus I S prime LM. So this is just really a definition of the vertex function, and the and this is S is defined to be the fermionic propagator, and it's just this definition is guaranteed to make the perturbative expressions that we did, the way I normalized everything before, agree with what we did before. So this is a connection between what I mean by the vertex function and a particular correlation function. And what I'm going to do is manipulate this correlation function using the fact that this current is conserved, and then make an inference about what this how the gamma and S related to each other, which is what we used when we were normalizing things.
Why the weird ordering for the
term? Oh, what was the, what's weird about it?
I was expecting the sidebar to be on the left. Is that going to be important for later? I guess you're not contracted, right? You're keeping these.
They're at separate points, so the order is probably going to be important, but I haven't thought about why this order. I mean, mostly, I guess what's happening is that the particles are coming in. You know, what I'm trying to do here is I've got a propagator, vertex function, and a propagator, and I've kind of amputated the external photon line. So I've got the current instead. And so the fermions on both sides are kind of playing the role of grading the particle that goes in perturbation theory. So that's probably why they're ordered that way. So it's probably history of the order is going to be important. Because I guess that's another way to say it. If I start putting complete sets of states in here, the only things that can possibly contribute are the things that have the charge of the electron. And here they have to have the charge of, you know, the thing that's destroyed by the electron. So this we're going to be taking, this is going to ensure that we're taking matrix elements of J between electron states, things that have the charge of electron states. If I put the J on the outside, then it's only going to be seeing matrix elements of neutral things, which is going to not be so interesting. Because it's electromagnetic current we're looking at. All right, so the S's, I need to define them in terms of correlation functions as well, and they're just the propagator. So minus I, the conventions I'm using are, it's just integral d4x e to the minus I e dot x of 0 time order product of the anti-commutator of psi n of x, psi bar m, and m of y. This is the, that's the time order product, not the anti-commutator. Right as a square bracket, so it's not a big deal. But you remember that the definition of time order product for fermions involves a sign. You know, the time order product for bosons is a sum of terms which have step functions in them, which tell you who's ordered, you know, who's which operator is coming later than which other operator. The same definition for fermions has alternating signs depending on how many times you'd have to rearrange the fermions. Because for the time ordering to be covariant, it has to be true that when these things are space-like separated, you don't care. So for bosons, things are commuting at space-like separation. And so the time ordering was defined in such a way that whenever x and y were space-like separated, so you can't decide who's first and who's second, you don't have to, even care because the ordering was irrelevant. And so for fermions, it has to be the same thing. And for fermions are actually anti-commuting at space-like separation. And so you set up the time ordering of fermionic operators in such a way that the signs are such that if you can't decide who's later and who's earlier between x and y, you don't care because you're anti-commuting the fermions at space-like separation. So just be aware that there are signs in here that you wouldn't have had for bosons. All right, what we want to use, you know, the thought that's behind all this is that we know that d mu j mu is equal to 0. That's the current conservation. And we also know that j is we know what it explicitly is as a function of the field control. And let me make sure I've got the factors of I right. So J mu is I times the charge times of our mu psi. It's the thing you normally would have assumed it to be. All right. So now all I want to do is take this thing and differentiate it, because I want to use the fact that delta of d mu j is equal to 0. So what I'll do is I'll take d d z mu of the
the time-ordered product of everybody in there. But I'm gonna reinstitute the, I'm gonna put back in the position coordinate for J so we can differentiate it. So x I n of x j mu of z sidebar m of y. Now if I differentiate, when the derivative goes inside and hits the j, I get zero. So the only thing I have to follow in taking this derivative is all the step functions that are imposing the time orderings. And so let's write that out. So this is dz mu of, so I'll write the first few lines and then stop because it gets out of hand pretty fast. So we have all possible orderings here, right? So we'll have a case where z naught is bigger than x naught, and then x naught is bigger than y naught, in which case we have j mu of z psi n x psi r m of y. Plus, we missed out lots of room here. Big of top and z naught. I'm often going to forget to write these knots here, so if I forget to write a knot inside a step function, you know what I mean. And here we get now one of these signs that come from the Fermionic definition of the time ordering. As the sidebar and side change order here. So I've just written all the time orderings, and there's a couple signs, and the signs come in when psi and sidebar change their relative order compared to one another, because they're fermions, and so that was part of the definition of the time ordering. So now we differentiate, and whenever the z hits the j, we get zero because it's conserved. And so all we have to do is pick off the delta functions we're going to get when we hit all these thetas. And you can kind of see they're going to group in a nice way. We're going to get basically things involving differences of operators. And let me just write down what you get when you do all those derivatives, just because otherwise it's just a mess to carry that through. But it's not complicated. It's just you got to be diligent when you do all the derivatives. So dz mu, well, the same thing as we had over there, is going to turn into delta of z naught minus x naught, theta of x naught minus y naught, commutator of y naught z psi n of x.
So you've got a bunch of commutators of currents with fermionic fields. But now we get to use something that we know what J is. You know, we're always getting J0 here because you know, the mu here was contracted with the J, with the J mu. So we had the time ordered product of psi J mu psi bar. Because the mu is being contracted, the derivative is only picking up the time derivative, so we're always picking up J0. So we're always getting a commutator of J0 with things. And what's great about J0 is that you know what its commutator is because basically you know, that, when mu is equal to 0, is the canonical momentum for psi. So the canonical momentum for psi, you know, if you calculate it using the QED Lagrangian, it would have been the derivative vector psi dot. And that's just minus psi bar gamma 0 m. And so that means that you can write J0 as being minus IQ times the momentum, we call this pi m with psi. And so in all these commutators, we've got psi with psi. I can trade this commutator. You know, if you take the commutator of A, B, C, I can always write it as being A, B, C. Well, the definition is it's A, B, C minus C, B, A. But I can write that as two anti-commutators, right? I can always write that as, by adding 0 in an artful way, I can write that as being A, B, C plus A, C, B minus A, C, B minus C, B, A. So that's A times the anti-commutator of B with C minus, oh, I did that badly, didn't
CBA
I?
CBA is wrong. It's CAB.
CAB, thank you. So minus the anti-commutator of A with C of B. So now I've got, if I think of this as being A and B, these commutators of J zeros with the psis, I can think of as being any commutators of the momentum with psi or of psi with psi. And so psi with psi is 0 and the momentum with psi is a delta function, but they're evaluatable in terms of using the canonical computation relations. If you use this and this to evaluate those, then everything here becomes delta functions and psis. So the upshot is, let me use that in the correlation function, and then you get the following statement. So we have dDz mu of, sorry, the time-ordered product of psi n of x j mu of z. The Q is coming from writing the current in terms of psi bars, and then this is the momentum and that's psi. So I'll have a delta 4 of z minus x. So the delta in time is combining with the delta in space coming from the canonical computation relations to give us a delta 4 times theta of 1 naught minus z naught psi m y psi n x. So if I what the hell are the next step? What happened there? No, I confused myself. Oh no. So this is, so what are these square brackets? This is what we would have meant by the time order product of psi with psi bar, right? This is a step function which gives you the two orders. It's a sign here because they're fermions. So we can write this as being Q delta 4 of z minus x times the time ordered product of yeah, you're right. Thank you. I think I got my delta function wrong here, right? This is z minus y. This is x minus z. This one came with the wrong order, yeah. So that minus sign became that one. And here, you get the plus sign. And the relative sign is just the sign to do with the ordering of two fermions. So we're almost there. So this is basically the thing that we had in their starting point, right? We start off with this. We've been looking, the thing that involves gamma and s, the definition is this thing. And we've basically got an expression involving what happens when we differentiate the thing inside the correlation function. And what's nice is it involves delta functions and things whose correlation functions are going to be propagators, the S's. And so if we take the matrix element of this thing in the vacuum, what we're expecting is some sort of relationship between S gamma S, which would be this thing, and propagators, which is what this thing is, S's. All right. So to get that statement, all we have to do is, here I'm probably beating you over the head, but we have to go back to the fact that we had z equals 0 over there. So the simplest way to do that is to use that, we know that if you take ddx mu plus ddy mu plus ddz mu of the time ordered product, that's zero. Because this is a function only of the differences between x and z and y. So if we add them all up, we're always going to get zero. And so that's kind of a poor man's way to allow us to get the derivative at zero in terms of other things. So let me write that here. Let me just get to the end here because we're close to the end and this is, I'd like to finish this topic off. So that tells us that integral d4x, d4y, of e to the minus I, d prime x plus I, dy, times minus ddx mu, minus ddy mu, correlation function is 0. Will be equal to Q times the integral d for x, d for y. I should have actually written that. For the purpose of the exercise here was to write this out here. So this is so that'll be equal to
over x c to the minus I p prime x I p y of d z mu. For which we can use our derivative story over there. It'll be q times integral d4x of the time ordered product just use this at z equals 0. And now we're basically done, because this thing Oh, no, I'm in good shape. Right. So if I take this thing and I take the derivatives, I can trade the derivatives for contractions between with p and p prime. And this thing is just propagators. So if you just Fourier transform everything and write out what it is in Fourier space, it's the answer we're looking for. Let me write that last line. All right, so the bottom line is, in a momentum space, if I'm using now this definition, then we're going to get I p minus p prime mu times I q minus I s prime and k p prime times gamma k l P so this came from using this in this, where the derivatives became the p minus p primes there. And on the other hand, we use this, that's equal to q times minus I s prime and m p prime minus q minus I s prime and m p. So if I kind of suppress these indices and write it in matrix notation, it's easier to see what to do next. So so matrix notation, this says I p minus p prime u times I q, because I times minus I goes away. We have S gamma mu S is equal to Q minus I Q S plus I Q S. This is a function of P prime, it's a function of P, and this was a function of P prime, that's a function of P. So as a matrix, that's what we got here, and I just stopped writing the indices. And so you can see that to get what we had before was an identity involving gamma. So we have to multiply by S inverse on both sides. So if we multiply on the left by S inverse of P prime and on the right by S inverse of P, that'll convert these things into S inverses. And so we have I. So then I guess we can cancel the I's. P minus P prime mu gamma mu P is equal to minus Q S inverse of P. So if I multiply through, that'll be S inverse of P prime minus S inverse. And that's what we used before. So the message is that this, you know, one of the things that these exact Heisenberg representation ways of phrasing things is useful for is driving exact results amongst correlation functions that follow from symmetry grounds or from on general arguments, which are then useful as when you're doing perturbation theory. It's useful to have the constraints that you know are holding exactly. They're also holding perturbatively, but it may be less clear why they're holding perturbatively if you're having to derive them order by order in perturbation theory. This shows you that it's always going to. This is going to be true any order in perturbation theory because it's really an exact statement that's applying to the correlation function.
Do you have a factor of Q?
Oh, did I screw something up here? The Q's should have canceled, right? Yeah. And that was because of the factor of Q that was defined in here. I think when we're doing perturbation theory, I might not have factored that Q out of the gamma. So there might have been a Q left over.
The second one we took out, you probably shouldn't because it's on the left hand as well.
Oh, yeah. So that's where I would stop from this stuff. So what you're getting from that is things like factorization theorems. Correlation functions are related in a very general way to S matrix elements. The Lehmann-Chalanian representation is giving you a very focused way to write correlation functions for field operators in terms of spectral functions. And they may or may not be useful depending on what you want to do. But you now have the tools. And so that's where I'd like to stop now. Next thing would be to do infrared divergences, and then that leads us to back to the renormalization group.